This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com. Wasting away again in
Margaritaville. It's Friday afternoon here, and I hope you're doing well. August 7th, 2009, and Rick Britton joins me live in studio, the one, the only. Rick Britton is back after a bit of a sabbatical, a lot of work to do. How are you doing? It's good to see you.
It's good to see you, too. I'm doing great.
Doesn't seem like Friday without you.
Oh, thanks, man.
I get emails all the time. Whatever happened to that Rick Britton fella? He was so... I loved having that Rick Britton fella in there. What happened to him?
Wow. Emails in slang.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Where's your Rick Britton fella? What happened to... He was a man that always knew the history and the... all the stories, and what happened to that Rick Britton fella?
I didn't know you did voices, man. You're good.
I don't. You're good. I just get indigestion. That's all it is.
I have been busier than a one-armed paper hanger.
Yeah.
I have been incredibly busy, but it's good.
Yeah.
Good busy.
You got a lot going on.
And folks know
that your bread and butter is your map work.
It is.
Your writing and your map work, and you got a lot of projects.
Lots and lots of projects. I've recently done some maps for Oxford University Press. I'm really proud of that.
Nice.
I'm doing some now for...
the O Press, the OP.
Yeah, OP.
Big
right.
time.
OUP.
Oxford.
OUP.
And OPE.
Oh, yeah. And I'm doing some for Yale, UK. I didn't know they had a press over there.
Wow.
I've been really, really super busy, but it's good.
Yeah. What
it's
kind of
real
maps
good.
For people who
love
your
work? For Oxford, it was a Jefferson-related book. It's about his governorship, and it's a book about his flight from Monticello. I don't remember the exact title, but it's by Michael Cranish. It'll be out next year. He's a writer. He covers Washington, D.C. and the White House for the Boston Globe. Pretty darn good writer.
A whole book about that period.
An entire book of Jefferson's governorship and the war here in Virginia during his governorship and his flight from Monticello.
There hasn't been a book about that specific.
Not specifically, no.
Yeah.
That
it's always mentioned in other books. But
Right. Briefly.
Yeah. That'll be really interesting to read.
It will be
interesting. So you had the map showing where Swan Tavern is?
The map showing basically Jefferson's Virginia and then a little inset showing his route from Monticello all the way down to Poplar Forest.
Which way did he go?
He went...
It sort of like Route 29 today?
It is sort of like Route 29, except that for a while he was on the eastern side of the Southwest Mountains.
Oh, interesting.
Not on the western side of the Southwest Mountains.
We drive on the western side
right.
today.
But when you think
you
about
take the highway to...
Yeah, but when you think about it, it makes sense because when Jefferson fled Monticello, the British were already in Charlottesville. So why would he go via Charlottesville? That would put him closer to the British.
Right.
So he wants to stay
so
on
he's
the eastern.
Came down the mountain and headed like towards Fluvanna.
Exactly.
And then south.
Exactly.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Because I know the main...
Well, not to Fluvanna, not that far east, but he crosses the river, he crosses Rockfish Gap, so it's on the eastern side, so like going to Blenheim.
And he made it. And his family was down there.
And his family went ahead of him. Yep. So that'll be an interesting book.
And the one
for Yale, it's a whole series of maps, and this is kind of interesting. I don't know anything about this, but it has to do with... all the exports out of Latin America during the 16th and the 1700s. So it's things like diamonds and gold and I think pearls, all kinds of things like that. So it shows the global trade routes going on in the 1600s and the 1700s. I misspoke. 16 and 1700s.
When the European powers discovered
that's right.
all the stuff there and
decided
to help themselves.
We can use this back home.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's
Thank
dig,
you very much.
Dig that up. Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah. Here's a gun.
Right.
I'll take that.
Here's a bronze axe or something.
Exactly.
You know? Thank
That's
you
right.
for all your gold.
Have a weapon. I'm taking that.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting.
That shiny stuff I like.
Yeah. We still do the same thing today.
We still do.
You know? Here, have a
gun.
Have a big gun on
right.
on a plane. Have a super duper plane and we'll take your oil, you know?
Or whatever. Rubber or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, whatever
yeah.
it is.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting.
We still do it, yeah.
So, what's going on?
Oh, man, I got a bunch of things. Just wanted to tell people really quickly that the Civil War Lecture and Day Trip series down at the Senior Center is ongoing, and every month we have a lecture and then a trip to that specific battlefield. So this coming Wednesday, October 9th, I'm giving a talk on the 19th Virginia Infantry in the Maryland campaign, specifically at the Battle of South Mountain, which was just 3 days before Sharpsburg, Antietam. So in explaining their movements in the Battle of South Mountain, it's a perfect lead-in to go to Sharpsburg. So we're going to do that.
Cool.
That my talk is Wednesday, August 19th, which is a couple of Wednesdays away. And then the very next week on Wednesday, the August 26th, we're going to Sharpsburg. So that's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So that's down at the Senior Center.
How many people died at that? Sharpsburg is the southern name. Antietam was the northern name. Right.
Let's see. Deaths, it's going to be about 8,000 deaths on one day.
Was it the bloodiest day?
It is the bloodiest single day in all of American history. The casualties, but get this, casualties, which include the wounded and a few captured and missing, not many, mostly wounded, on both sides, totaled 25,000 men on one day.
Killed and injured.
Killed and wounded, yeah.
Wow.
Why was it? Because total insanity.
I mean, Rick, they're fighting for years in places like Wilderness and Gettysburg.
Those are afterwards.
Yeah, but what is it about this particular battle day that caused such devastation?
Great question, and there's a very simple answer. The simple answer is Robert E. Lee is backed up to the Potomac, and there was one ford across the Potomac. So it's like he's here at Sharpsburg behind Antietam Creek, and he has to fight there. Once McClellan's army catches up to him, he pretty much has to fight. It's not as if he can run away. It takes a while to get an army of 40,000 men over one ford of the Potomac. You got me?
Yeah. And it wasn't a bridge. It was just a place where
a ford. Yeah, not a bridge.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's tougher at a ford.
Right.
Think of all the wagons. Think of all the artillery that has to ford the Potomac, Potomac River.
And a ford, for folks who don't know, is just like a road under the water.
Yeah.
It's just where the road...
Yeah, not a Bentley or a Lincoln, but a ford.
right.
Yeah.
Wow. So he was cornered.
He basically was cornered, but he also chose to fight there. He also chose to fight there. Up to that time, the army had been pretty much undefeated. The Army of Northern Virginia under Robert E. Lee had been pretty much undefeated. In his first 3 months... in command of the Army of Northern Virginia were really spectacular. Think of what had happened. What he had done in 3 months was amazing. McClellan and the Army of the Potomac, 120,000 men, were so close to Richmond that the officers were setting their pocket watches by the bells in the church steeples in Richmond. They could see from some of the hills they were on, they could see Richmond. They were that close. And in 3 months, Robert E. Lee backed them all the way down to Harrison's Landing on the James River, so made them retreat from Richmond, outnumbered 2-1, then drove another force out of Northern Virginia under John Pope, and then undertook an invasion of the North.
What was his secret? I mean, what was he doing that the previous generals hadn't done?
One word, audacity. Audacity.
So where other generals might have said, okay, boys, let's rest here and stop, he said, let's keep going.
Let's keep going. And because of that, McClellan already had a propensity for overestimating his opponents. And if you're fighting somebody who's going to overestimate your capacity and you're audacious, it's going to feed into his psychological problem. You follow me?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what happened.
Interesting.
Is that amazing?
Yeah. So he had to fight his way out of that corner he got backed into,
right.
And that's why it was so bloody.
Right, right. And most people, I mean, a lot of diehard Southerners would say that it was a draw, but really when you have to give up the battlefield, and he did after another day and a half, then it's a loss.
Right, right.
He
lost ground.
Goes into the loss column.
We're talking with Rick Britton, and he is back live in studio. At about 15 minutes until the hour of 5 p.m. Hoss Spencer coming up at 5, but Rick Britton back from sabbatical, a very busy man, and you have your Civil War lecture and day trip series, and that is ongoing.
We were just talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's coming up. That lecture of mine is coming up on Wednesday, October the 19th at 6. But then in September, I'm going to be teaching a class on the early history of the University of Virginia. This is going to be a lot of fun. And this one's called Tales of the University. So it's going to cover Jefferson founding the university and then all of the amazing names associated basically with the first 100 years of the University of Virginia. You know, people that they might have heard of, like, for example, the Marquis de Lafayette, James Madison, who actually took over as rector after Jefferson's death. Nobody really knows that James Madison was actually rector of the University of Virginia, the equivalent of president. People like Poe, Professor William Holmes McGuffey, Mosby, John Hartwell Cock, Walter Reed, was a graduate of the University of Virginia Medical School. Jimmy McConnell has that great statue to him, Winged Victory, right outside of Alderman Library, one of my favorite statues in Charlottesville. So we're going to talk about all of these amazing people and the amazing events of the first 100 years.
Very cool. Now, University. How can folks get, this will be at the Senior Center.
This is going to be at the Senior Center, and call down, the number is 974-6538. And you can see the schedules for all of these on the website, the Senior Center website, and that's at www.seniorcenterinc.org.
There you go. Rick Britton is back live in studio here on Charlottesville right now. It's a beautiful afternoon. It's about 81 degrees, and I hope you're doing well. Coy Barefoot, let's take a very quick break. More with Rick when we get back. We're talking with Rick Britton. He's live in studio. Glad to have him back. He's been on sabbatical, very hard at work. Mark is on line one. Mark, you're on with Rick Britton, my friend. Happy Friday. Go right ahead.
Well, thanks so much, and it is a lovely Friday. Rick, my question is, between the West Range and the gardens of the West Lawn, there are a couple of huge iron column capitals in there. Do you know the origins of those?
If I'm not, let's see. You know, I used to.
Those are from unaware. Yeah.
Hey, come on now, Rick.
Okay, hold on a second. If I'm not mistaken,
I know where
they're from the original. They're the original ones that from the fire.
They're from the annex, which was added onto the rotunda.
There you go. Coy's got it.
Onto the north end of the rotunda in 1853, I think.
Right.
It was the largest meeting hall in the South. They desperately needed classroom space because they had a sort of a boom in student population in the late 1840s, and when the railroad came to town. So they added on this annex. That's where the fire started in 1885.
Exactly.
When that burned down, they had all these bits of columns and old things left over, and they used them in the gardens.
In the electrical laboratory.
Okay, great.
That's where the fire
started.
Hey,
thanks, Mark. Appreciate
it. Good question.
Very good question.
Yep. Yeah, man.
Because people walking around the gardens see those big columns and wonder where they came from. Now, you've been busy up at the
International Center for Jefferson Studies.
Yes,
indeed. I had another fellowship. I was really honored to have another one, and it was a lot of fun researching and writing about all of those gadgets, all of those amazing whiz-bang things inside the house. For some reason, and this is what gets me, and this is why I did it, everybody on the planet, all the visitors, think that Thomas Jefferson invented all of those things, when in fact, the things that you see inside the house and just outside on the North Terrace, none of them he invented. Teachers will come with their school groups. I've taken them through the house where the teacher will go, okay, kids, as we're going through the house, ask the tour guide about all of Mr. Jefferson's wonderful inventions.
He was an amazing inventor.
He was such an inventor. And I've actually said, well, you know what, kids, I have to tell you, your teacher is wrong.
He didn't invent anything.
Didn't invent any of these things, but I'll tell you the
he
stories as we go through the house.
For that plow, but that was about it,
he actually didn't get a patent. He was against patents on principle, even though as Secretary of State, he oversaw the establishment of the patent office.
Even though he didn't believe in patents.
Didn't believe in patents because he believed it was a hindrance to the diffusion of knowledge.
It just slowed it down.
It slowed everything down. Yeah. If you give somebody an exclusive right for 50 years, it slows down everybody else getting a hold of it.
Right. So, people like Thomas Jefferson who want to get a hold of an idea and put it in their
house.
Right away.
So there's amazing things like, you know, if you go in order through the house, and I'm sure all the listeners have been through the house, and if you haven't been through the house, go there tomorrow. The folding ladder, which was used for the Great Plantation Clock. Some people will tell you, and you look on the internet, and there's a bunch of websites that some of them even list, and they're aimed at kids. That's what kills me, too. Some of them will even list the Great Plantation Clock as an invention of Thomas Jefferson's, as if he was a clockmaker, right? The folding ladder used to rewind the clock, the polygraph, the single-acting double doors, which are also sometimes called the double-acting double doors, or self-acting double doors, or automatic double doors. There's a bunch of different names. The wine bottle dumbwaiters, the revolving book stand, revolving serving door, spherical sundial that's out on the North Terrace. That's just a few of the items. Some people will tell you that Jefferson invented the revolving chair, that he invented the movable camp stool. The list just goes on and on and on.
But he saw all these things elsewhere first and said, oh, I want one of those.
Pretty much. That's pretty much the short answer to all of them. Some of the more interesting ones, though, the wine bottle dumbwaiters, were pretty sure, I'm pretty sure now, after doing the research, that he saw this in the Café Mécanique. Café Mécanique was in the Palais Royal in Paris, and it was this amazing place with all of these kinds of gadgets in this restaurant that Jefferson frequented while he was over there.
Cool.
As minister plenipotentiary. And it had, for example, a speaking tube so that when you placed your order, the kitchen was below where you were eating. And so the maitre d' or whoever it was who took your order would lift the speaking tube and send the order down via this speaking tube, like you'd see a captain use in a tugboat.
Yeah, or like those things they have on kids' playgrounds now where you can talk into one end of the playground and
that's it.
Listen on the other end.
That's it. And outside, of, in the middle of the table, sometimes your meal would come up. But also your drink order would come up via a dumbwaiter up the legs of your table. The table legs were really big. So you can just see Jefferson there sketching down all these amazing gadgets.
Yeah. So when he gets back from Paris, he's like, oh, because we know when he got back from Paris, well, he was there 1784 to 1789. And when he got back, he totally wanted to redo Monticello.
Right.
Because he had so many. Then wanted to do the dome and all this.
Add skylights.
Yeah, everything. Yeah. All these
all
things he had seen in Europe.
Indoor privies.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he brought this idea for these gadgets with him back from Europe that he had seen over there.
Right. Also, probably the idea for a revolving.
And paid for it all with credit.
That's right. Right. So the family ended up paying for it much later.
Yeah.
Kind of sounds familiar, huh, folks? So he also in Europe saw revolving chairs. And that's where he and Washington actually simultaneously in New York City bought revolving chairs, like the one that you see in front of his writing getup. But the one that really kills me is the Hawkins and Peel polygraph, because if you look closely on the little box that houses this mechanism, and it is amazing mechanism, thanks to the polygraph, and polygraph is Greek for many writings or many signings. So
is that that thing that allowed him to copy a letter while he wrote one?
It absolutely.
Created
so
a copy.
It makes another copy. It actually has reservoir pens, not dip pens on it. And there were models of the polygraph with as many as 5 pens.
I'm so glad you said that, because I've often wondered, how would the copying pen, would he have to pull that out every once in a while and dip it?
Or? It's actually a fairly modern, for its time, reservoir pen.
It's almost like a fountain pen.
Yeah, it is a fountain pen. It's a reservoir pen that they were called reservoir pens back then. But if you look closely on the label, it says Model 1804 Hawkins and Peel polygraph.
So he bought it.
It doesn't say Thomas Jefferson's polygraph.
He's a great inventor.
It's the Hawkins and Peel polygraph because Dr. John Isaac Hawkins of London invented it, and he granted the American patent rights to a close friend of Jefferson's, Charles Wilson Peel. Now, Jefferson made some suggestions. He was always trying to improve everything. So Peel and he are corresponding about this. And so Jefferson wrote, tried it out and made some suggestions and sent the model back, and they'd send him another one, try this. So
fair to say he
so
was
he's helping them out.
Yeah, fair to say, Rick, that he was a hell of a tinkerer, but not an inventor.
Tinkerer is the word.
Yeah.
He was always tinkering.
And tinkering with gardens and music and democracy.
Government.
And architecture.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Tinkering with everything. Tinkering with words.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Rick Britton, local author, historian, cartographer. You can check him out online at rickbritton.com. He's been on sabbatical this summer to catch up on a lot of work. You can see some of that work at rickbritton.com, some of his maps there. We're honored to have him back live in studio on Friday afternoons. And if you need more information about his courses he's teaching, give the Senior Center a call over there at
974-6538.
There you go. Rick, thanks so much.
Thank you, man.
Have a great weekend.
You too.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.